Okay, so these days, with the more obvious advance of economic and environmental crisis conditions, we've got the destructive and ruthless nature of the capitalist system being made more obvious, as I think a lot of people can see with foreclosed homes in the United States, bank bailouts everywhere that are pissing people off, austerity measures imposed because banks have all the money, so social programs get axed, the climate crisis, etc., etc. So the lives of ordinary people are being made more difficult, both here and globally. Some in Canada, you could say the process is happening a little slower. Some places, it's very dramatic. A lot of people who define themselves as opposed to capitalism have seen this as an opportunity to advance ideas of different forms of social organization. People saying, well, now look how bare everything is. It's so obvious to people. Now we should definitely be able to go further with our ideas. But then there's a lot of talk about how such opportunities are being lost because this process has not unfolded itself, that there hasn't been a mass realization that things have got to go with capitalism and we've got to do something differently. So this is often described as a failure of social movements to seize the opportunity in response to crisis conditions. So what I think this concern that these different communities express about not being able to seize this opportunity is both an expression of how isolated these movements have become from ordinary working and poor people, and simultaneously a realization that unless working and poor people, people in marginalized communities everywhere, are involved in social struggles en masse, there's absolutely no leverage to produce the lofty social changes that we want, that anti-authoritarian opponents of capitalism are calling for. So in Canada and the U.S., again, it doesn't really look like large transformations are taking place. So I'm asking, do you agree with what I'm saying about the lack of appearance of these transformations, if you want to comment on that? And also, if you have any ideas of where you do see really positive transformations taking place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first of all, I really do agree with your assessment there. There's a couple of things to say about it. I mean, one is... my friend Claire Bayard, who works with the Catalyst Project in San Francisco, often says, in fact, we do live in revolutionary times. We're just not the ones who are leading the revolution. The right is leading the revolution and is drastically changing the conditions in which we live. The ruling class is winning right now in a class war. And that's pretty dire. And I definitely agree with the assessment that the failure of the left, the failure of left social movements to make use of the moment of the last 2 to 3 years of the economic crisis, to really move, right, to really put forward a different narrative about capitalism and what it doesn't do for people and ecosystems, that failure on the left is not just a failure of the left in this moment, but a failure of the left in the last couple of decades, really, because the right has been in many ways able to move on this moment, especially in the United States, right, with the rise of the Tea Party. But I mean, even if we look at the recent election in Toronto too, we can see, right, the real capacity of right-wing forces to move in this moment when people everywhere are feeling pervasive material insecurity. And on the left, we haven't done the groundwork to actually be able to speak to people in a way that I think is relevant and understandable, and at the same time offer a compelling alternative story about what's going on. So in any case, that's all just to say, absolutely, I agree with your assessment, and it scares me, quite frankly. I see small glimpses of left movements that are doing things that I think show some promise for where we might go. Maybe I'll talk about those first, and then I'll talk about what I see more of happening right now and how I don't think it's enough. Now, in terms of the positive things that I find promising, I think about initiatives like Take Back the Land in the United States, which is happening largely around Miami, but there are actually a number of loosely related initiatives that are basically working with people against evictions and are working proactively to seize unused land and put people in homes that are unoccupied. I think that that's the kind of aggressive and, in fact, proactive form of action that we actually need right now. It's speaking to people's specific needs to have places to live And at the same time, it's actually challenging a key part of capitalist logic, which is around the sanctity of private property, right? It's actually more important for people to have a place to live than it is for us to protect private property. And I think that has to be at the core of a viable anti-capitalism right now. At the same time, I'm very impressed with what No One Is Legal collectives have managed to do in Canada over the last 8 to 9 years, depending on which city we're talking about. I think those circumstances have been very, very hard. I think what's happening with the immigration regime under Jason Kenney is really scary, and against pretty well-resourced forces in the federal government, No One Is Legal collectives have been challenging deportations and really putting forward a completely different idea about borders and whether people have a right to be here, and in the best cases, actually connecting those questions to the reality that Canada exists on stolen Indigenous land, and that colonialism infuses any way that we talk about borders and land and territory. So, I mean, those are small examples. I think, you know, there have been a handful of workplace occupations that have happened in different parts of North America. Of course, there was the one that happened in Chicago at the window and door factory that many people on the left were very excited about, but it didn't actually blossom into much wider occupations. However, we've seen a lot of use of occupation within the student movement in the United States. I think sometimes with unrealistic expectation that a campus occupation is going to catalyze a whole chain of workplace occupations, when in fact those are two very different kinds of institutions. But I do see promise in the tactic of occupation in a moment when people are getting squeezed out of so many kinds of public space through all kinds of forms of austerity measures. So those are some positive things. Now let me talk a little bit about some stuff that's going on that I'm a little bit more concerned about. I've been thinking a lot recently about the 1990s and the kinds of neoliberal austerity measures that happened then in all sorts of different parts of North America. Think about the Harris regime in Ontario, for example. And I think there was some really amazing kinds of activism and organizing that happened in that period, but often it was very much focused on fighting against particular initiatives, fighting against cuts to particular kinds of social services, you know, fighting different kinds of fee hikes at universities and so on. And in that way, even though some of those moments grew into big explosions of anger, they had a very difficult time hooking up and coming together in a sort of larger movement against austerity. And I'm concerned in the current moment that we're going to see more of that kind of dynamic. Where I live in Sudbury, for example, there's a long and beautiful history of union militancy and class struggle. And there was a year-long strike at one of the big mining companies in the last year. And currently there's another strike happening at the medical school. What concerns me is that these kinds of strikes may be happening, or there may be different kinds of campus confrontations that happen around cuts to higher education, but that they may not be able to connect and actually blossom into what we actually need, which is not just individual fights against particular austerity measures, but actually a generalized confrontation with the austerity regime that's being rolled in right now with the justification that we're in an economic crisis and everybody has to tighten their belts. When, of course, not everybody's tightening their belts. The richest people are actually getting much, much more comfortable.
You mentioned campus occupations. I just want to get into that for a second again. You were saying that there's a difference in quality of these campus occupations versus workplace occupations. And I think I know what you're saying there, but if you just wanted to elaborate on what you mean by a campus occupation, mm-hmm. what are people doing in the cases you're talking about when they're occupying a campus?
For sure. That's a good question. I should have been more specific about that. I mean, what's happened, particularly in the last academic year of 2009-2010, it kind of remains to be seen what's going to develop this year. But what happened last year was that in California especially, there was a whole round of university occupations that actually looked like many different things, depending on what campus we're talking about, but could often mean a group of student activists organizing on their campus to bring in other students and take over an administrative building and say, we're not going to pay for your crisis, because so much of what's happening right now in all educational systems in California is funding cuts that are affecting especially people in the humanities and social sciences, and are definitely affecting students and workers on those campuses. So it's getting more expensive to go to school, people are getting laid off, everybody's really concerned about the future. So these campus occupations, like I said, could involve those kinds of building occupations. They've involved certain kinds of campus blockades, and there's also been some experimentation with bringing people together to have general assemblies where students and then inviting workers, although it's hard to sometimes bridge that divide, to participate in discussions about, so what do we want to do with this occupation movement? Where do we want to go with it? And now it has had some spinoffs. I mean, in San Francisco, for example, some people have been deeply inspired by that occupation experience and have gone on to start occupying abandoned buildings and calling for housing for homeless people. And I think that's good. I think it's great to sort of move outside the university, take some of that energy and begin thinking about how to connect it concretely in other specific kinds of struggle.
One thing that speaks to me about that, the examples that you described, there's actually differences between them as well. Even though they might, upon appearances or when you first hear them, all sound very similar, there's different qualities to the campus occupation, to the workplace occupation, or in the case of Take Back the Land in Miami, mm-hmm. where people aren't occupying the houses just so that they can convince the government to give them the houses. They're occupying the houses to stay in them.
That's right.
So
that's
right. There's a difference between using the tactic of taking the space to leverage something that you want from what is still the higher power, so to speak, but when you're just taking it because you're going to take it and you need it.
Right. That's so, right. That's yeah. right. And I mean, to be fair, I think these are political questions that have played out really intensively within the student occupation movement. And I can't speak to it in a really knowledgeable way because I haven't been present within that context. But definitely there have been pretty intense debates around this question of, are we seizing buildings simply to take them over and create our new vision? Are we seizing buildings simply to essentially push some demand through about, you know, not having this particular fee hike? You know, what are we doing? I think that those are questions that are really worth talking about. Personally, I'm in favor of occupying things and trying to take them back, but I do think that it's important to understand that we are within this context, right? We're within this capitalist context, and we have to figure out ways to win things, to actually make demands that can be transformative demands that feel like we're getting somewhere, and that can actually shift the terrain of struggle in such a way that we are a little bit more successful or have new possibilities for struggling in new ways. So I'm not completely opposed to the idea of making demands. I think they're sometimes really essential.
Yeah, this is more like the idea of being strategic, basically, and not getting into a fight which is just going to result in things getting worse. You end up with a regression instead of progression. Right. More intense rules and regulations are created over your workplace or institution because you failed so miserably at attempting to do something that was far beyond your capacity.
That's right. So yeah, just as an aside on that, I think an important way to think about it is the way that Pauline Wang, who's a Toronto-based organizer, has often talked with me about how do we fight in a way that even if we lose, we win, right? So the way that we organize, how we run the campaign, and the kind of power that we build collectively with people, and not just activist people, but actually the power that we build with ordinary working people or poor people, how do we fight in such a way that even if we don't get what we're calling for, we've actually strengthened ourselves through that struggle, and we're actually tighter and more, you know, more cohesive, and feel a greater sense of our own power for going back again and trying to fight.
Yeah, and the context could be different in each place. In Miami, it's so desperate a need that it does make sense to do that there, and they have the capacity, and in another place it doesn't. So those all have to be evaluated, and that's something for the people in those communities to do. So, I'm really interested in getting into the idea of strategy more deeply. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one about basically kind of a debate. Some people who define themselves as anarchists, and anyone who calls themselves communist, basically, would name capitalism and the class struggle as being the main struggle in which other oppressions, like racism, patriarchy, etc., there's many more, are located and controlled. They're all mediated through the social relations of capitalism. However, you speak of interlocking oppressions. So how do you respond to someone who says that there needs to be a focus on capitalism, that needs to be like the primary enemy that we see that we're facing, and we have to somehow deal with the other oppressions along the way, but not look at them as the primary focus? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with someone who says that?
I respond by saying that I understand the desire for a focus, and I think so often radical activism right now feels like a constant sort of overwhelming sense of having too many things that we're trying to focus on at once. But at the same time, I really do think that it's a mistake to understand capitalism conceptually as the sort of main enemy, with these other things being important, but somehow kind of underneath it. I mean, I tend to take the view that Hamani Banerjee advances, and she's a really important anti-racist feminist in Toronto, and she talks about capitalism and racism and sexism as working with and through each other. And I don't think that we can actually talk about a capitalism that is not deeply enmeshed in how race happens. So I don't think that we can talk about, for example, poverty without talking about the fact that people in poverty are disproportionately people of color and indigenous people. I don't think we can talk about the character of poverty without thinking about how women are responsible for caring for children within how patriarchal relations happen. And that means that women experience poverty in a very different way than men experience poverty. And it's just, that's just one example, but we can think about it in any number of ways in terms of how people get sorted into particular kinds of jobs. I mean, think about, for example, the kinds of people who frequently get pushed into working as custodians, or people who get pushed into working as healthcare workers or teachers, or any of the number of ways that gender and race and class actually shape how people's lives are lived. And I think we have to have a realistic and sufficiently complicated way of talking about that if we're actually going to be able to speak to people's realities and organize in ways that make sense. Now, at the same time, I think it's crucial to talk about capitalism. I think one of the unfortunate things that has often happened in relation to, let's say, a lot of feminist work is that capitalism can drop out of the picture. And we're not actually talking about class inequality at the same time as we're talking about gender oppression. And we're not talking about the way that capitalism in so many ways shapes the circumstances, the material circumstances, in which all of this is happening. So, I mean, I think it's complex. And I don't think we can escape the complexity. Just to give one example, I don't think that it's possible to talk about radical social change in Canada just in terms of capitalism, simply because we have to talk about colonialism. We have to talk about the land on which we're struggling, and the fact that there is a whole chunk of people who live on this land who have not been fully incorporated into the capitalist system because of the way in which colonialism has set up certain kinds of indigenous people on reserves.
Actually, when I look at native struggles, what they are fundamentally about is control over land, mm-hmm. so that the people that have lived there for many, many generations prior to colonization had control over the entire social relations of their society. So it fundamentally, inevitably, is a struggle against the capitalist social order, which says, well, you have the land only if you can pay for it.
Right.
You know, so in the end, it ends up being a struggle against capitalism, even though it's often not defined as that.
That's true.
But anyway, that's more complicated in terms of like how struggles are being defined and
who gets to define them.
Who gets to define them? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the only thing I would add to that is just that one thing I think it's important not to lose sight of whenever we're talking about all of these different forms of exploitation and oppression is that there is a very small group of people that is very rich, that's making a lot of money right now and has a tremendous amount of power. And all of these different forms of oppression and exploitation are creating a context in which a ruling class is really benefiting. And the rest of us, to varying degrees, are really not benefiting, and some of us are really hurting. And I think we can't lose sight of that picture, right? We have to be clear that we have enemies. We have enemies who are benefiting from the way the social order is set up, and those are the people we have to fight.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to get back to... I'm going forward, because this is further down the list of questions. So in your summary, you didn't mention a strand of anarchism or an anti-authoritarian current that was specifically focused on class struggles, such as movements that you can say were much more prominent about 75 to 100 years ago around that time, like a lot of the International Workers of the World, which is often identified as kind of an anarchist-influenced working-class movement. So it doesn't really appear to me that such movements are really around in Canada and the United States. Feel free to disagree. Do you have any comments on this, about what happened to that sort of tradition?
I think this is a really important question. I mean, there's a couple of different ways I'm going to answer it. I mean, the first one is a little bit more conceptual, and that's just to say that when I use the term working class, and I use it a lot, I think of working class in a kind of autonomous way, which means that I think of the working class as very broad, as including people who are not only getting paid for their work at working at the coffee shop or the factory or whatever, but people who aren't getting paid for their work but are actually still part of the working class. They're still actually making the capitalist system function. So these are people who are working at home taking care of children. These are people who are currently in prison. That's the whole working class. And I think it's important to make that distinction when we're talking about the class struggle, because I think there are clusters of anti-authoritarian organizers who are doing work that is actually working class organizing, for example, in migrant communities. But it maybe doesn't look like what we think of as classical working class organizing, which is going into the factory and organizing a union and organizing what in that context were predominantly white working class men to go on strike and that sort of thing. So I do think we need to actually think more broadly about what is class struggle right now and who's participating in that class struggle. And that pushes us, I think, as activists too, to actually pay more attention to what's going on around us and who is actually fighting and what kinds of implication those fights have for pushing back against capitalism. That's one way I wanted to answer this. Now, the other thing is that it's true that I think there's a lot less of, particularly on the anti-authoritarian left, and especially among anarchists, there's a lot less of this kind of explicit identification with class struggle. And I think there are complex reasons for that. In the United States especially, I think there's actually a fundamental... it's almost like I tend to think of it as a historic rupture that happened in the 1950s with the McCarthyist period, right? When there were these intense investigations at the highest levels of government that scoured the whole country looking for anyone who might be a communist or a communist sympathizer. And actually, so much of popular culture came to understand communism as being synonymous with the Soviet Union and with these kind of demonic, monstrous people who were going to hurt us. And because of that, actually, so many people lost that connection to that tradition of class struggle from the earlier period that you're associating with groups like the Industrial Workers of the World, but was actually present in so much radical organizing around the turn of the century leading up well into the Depression. And this happened in Canada to some extent as well, this kind of historic rupture, although I think had a different character, and actually there were more people who were able to carry that class struggle tradition over a bit further and kind of maintain that long historical view. So that's true. But then I'm going to actually disagree with you a little bit and say that there is a strand of explicitly anarchist activity in both the U.S. and Canada that identifies as class struggle anarchism. And there are actually a whole bunch of organizations. They're tiny groups, but they are very ambitious. I mean, in Ontario, Common Cause is a provincial-wide anarchist organization that identifies as a class struggle organization and is really trying to orient itself to anti-capitalist struggle based in working class and poor communities, really focusing on capitalism as a kind of primary force in people's lives. And these organizations actually exist all over. In the Pacific Northwest of the United States, there's Common Action, there's the Workers' Solidarity Alliance, which is a much longer-term organization. For very many years within the northeastern United States and parts of eastern Canada, where there was the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, and there are still people associated with that formation too. So, and these people have conferences at the national level, and actually try to pound out common strategies for how they're going to do work. And many of them are deeply involved in workplace organizing. And they overlap a little bit with the industrial workers of the world, which hasn't died.
No.
You know, it's actually carried on, although it's very different now than it was in the 1920s or the 19-teens. And, you know, has done some amazing work, particularly organizing in Starbucks.
Right.
And I think just based on the little I know and the few people I've talked to who've been involved, I think is really advancing an interesting idea about organizing in service industries among very low-wage workers and in very precarious circumstances, right, where people don't have regular work hours, where management can just fire them very easily with basically just making up stuff. And so I think there does actually continue to be maybe a little corner of the anti-authoritarian left where people are talking quite seriously about class struggle in very explicit ways, in ways that sometimes I think are a little bit limited because they maybe don't have quite that same kind of breadth of view that I was talking about at the beginning. But at the same time, I think they actually have a lot to contribute and should not be dismissed at all.
Yeah, I guess I was mentioning things in a way almost to say that certain things have vanished out of existence, and I didn't mean to imply that as much as a difference in scale, a massive, what seems to be, I think it's fair to say, a difference in scale of activity. Yeah. Like the International Workers of the World was considered a huge force in the United States at one point.
And in Canada, too. In the West, especially.
Yeah, and at one point were considered a huge threat to the social order in mainly the United States, not so much in Canada, but would not be seen today as having that same kind of character.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned some of those examples. So. Yeah. I guess I just wanted to ask you what you really learned through the process of writing this book. Like what do you feel like you've gained through this experience?
Well, I mean, there are actually many things, and I can probably only talk about a few of them in the time that we have available. I think that the first one that I would really want to flag is just that, quite honestly, working on this project, even during some kind of dismal years, you know, with the economic recession and some very serious questions for the left. So even during a difficult time, working on this project has given me a lot of hope. And I think part of that has been simply based on me going and spending time with people who are doing really interesting, innovative organizing work that we don't hear about much, that isn't super high profile, isn't really sexy, doesn't involve like enormous numbers of people or really intense confrontations, but is the kind of daily grind of organizing migrant workers in the fields in BC, or organizing students in different parts of the United States to push at the bounds of how student organizing often happens, or organizing with people who were very recently incarcerated in prisons and trying to figure out ways to develop mechanisms so they don't end up back in prison and can actually live in much healthier communities that aren't reliant on police to make them healthy communities. In fact, police never make them healthy communities. I have felt like throughout working on this project, I've had these little glimpses of bits and pieces of what's happening across the continent, and I have felt really fortunate to get those glimpses and feel like we often don't take ourselves as seriously as a radical left in North America as we really should. There's much that we are doing and much more that we need to be doing, but I do think there's some foundation for building on. And I think there are a lot of people who at this point are asking very deep questions, very deep and necessary questions about how are we going to win? How are we going to actually change things? And that to me is tremendously exciting, because we're not asking the questions of how do we continue to work within insular subcultural scenes. We're asking harder questions about how do we move beyond that? How do we actually do stuff that's consequential in the world? And for the fate of the planet and for all of us who inhabit this planet, I hope that we can start developing some big answers to those questions and working on a scale that we absolutely need to be working on. So that's one thing I feel that I've learned. You know, the other thing is I've learned that part of how we're going to go about addressing really big questions about what kind of organizing do we need to be doing right now, you know, what is organizing going to look like to be adequate to the moment that we're in, or what sorts of institutions and organizations do we need to be building to actually create the infrastructure for a revitalized left, or questions around, you know, how do we work with the ways that power and privilege so often come into play within the very liberatory spaces that we're trying to create. All these questions, there are no easy answers. That's, I think, a core part of what I've learned. And there are no formulas. There are no recipes. We're not going to be able to write cookbooks for how to be radical organizers in every single community, working on every single kind of campaign. Instead, we're going to have to learn to experiment. And I think in many cases, we are experimenting in really useful ways. Maybe the last thing I'd say is, I'm from the US originally. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've learned through working on this whole project is that most people in the US don't pay any attention to what's happening in Canada. And this includes most people on the US left. And I think that's incredibly unfortunate, because I think there's so much to actually learn from the Canadian context that would be really useful in the US. I mean, among many other things, in Canada there is such a higher consciousness about the legacies of colonialism than there is in the United States. In the US, within very specific pockets, but for the most part, even radicals are very rarely talking about indigenous struggles in the US context. And there's very interesting and useful stuff that people are doing in terms of anti-poverty work and migrant justice organizing in Canada. So I'm glad that I've been able to experience some of this, and I'm hoping with this project to actually create some more cross-border communication between organizers who I think have a lot to contribute to one another.